Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
On the PR Moment podcast this week, we're talking about the lack of working class people working in public relations in the UK. In an attempt to increase the number of opportunities for working class people in PR, Sarah Waddington and Stephen Waddington have launched Socially Mobile. For those of you that haven't heard, Socially Mobile is a not-for-profit that offers people in PR with 1 or 2 to 3 years experience training to develop and turbocharge their careers. It delivers training to those from lower social economic backgrounds, as well as the underrepresented and underserved groups, including Black, Asian and ethnic minority practitioners, women returners and those with disabilities. The eventual aim of the organisation is to increase the amount of talent from lower income backgrounds and underrepresented groups to make the public relations sector more representative and diverse. Before we start, thanks so much to PR Moment podcast sponsors, the PRCA. And for those observant amongst you, you'll have noticed that the PR Moment Awards are now open for entries. Do take a look at the homepage of the awards microsite for more info on the categories and entry deadlines. Sarah and Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for having us on.
So go on then. Just talk us through the demographic imbalances that I guess we see in the UK public relations sector and how you see that that those are an issue for the sector going forward.
Yeah, good place to start. And I'm going to apologise in advance to your listeners for my croaky COVID voice. Still slightly on my deathbed, or not quite a deathbed, but we're back and didn't want to pass up this opportunity. So thanks again for having us on. But yeah, why Socially Mobile? Why now? And what's the issue? Our industry is quite an interesting one. Most people probably don't know that the number of privately educated professionals in PR is actually 3 times the national average. According to the PRCA's PR and communication census, and this is the 2020 to 2021 figures, half, which is 52% of practitioners, attended a state-run or funded non-selective school, followed by independent or fee-paid school at 20%, state-run or funded selective school at 90%, and school outside the UK, 8%. So basically, if you even just take those figures on face value, you can see immediately that we have a serious socioeconomic diversity issue. Now, you pair that, interestingly, with a report that was done by the Creative Industries Policy and Evidence Centre. And this is called Social Mobility in the Creative Economy, Rebuilding and Levelling Up. And it's a really good read. So I would urge anybody to dig it out and have a look. But this is really interesting. And also a little bit worrying, because this says the UK creative industries as a whole is missing more than 250,000 working class voices. And that's a deficit which is almost equal to the increase in jobs in the sector over the past 5 years. And again, if you group these figures together, you start to get a picture overall of the issues facing our sector, not just PR and comms, but creative industries altogether. And ultimately, what's happening, in short, is that we're becoming a bit of a closed shop unless you have money, influence, networks. And actually, if you're from a lower socioeconomic or working class background, as another way of explaining it, you just don't have those. And it's making the opportunity to get into PR a very limited one.
And just give it, what's normal from a school background, if you see what I mean? So you said there that 52% of the PR sector is state school, roughly.
We have 3 times the national average. So they have, basically 3 times more than the average people who go to state school are privately educated in PR. So, I mean, it's quite significant.
So on that, it's somewhere around 15% or 18% is normal, and we're at 52.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's high. And if you imagine that just by the way we do things normally, people do things, human nature, if you recruit in your own, shape, unfortunately, what happens is there is a kind of bias that creeps in, and it means that you tend to recruit people who are in your own image. And so the issue self-fulfills in many respects. And I know we're going to come on to recruitment and retention in a little while, but this is an issue.
Yeah, but just to dig into that a bit further, I was going to ask, why do you think that is? But do you put it down to that, I don't know, recruitment bias? It can't entirely be down to that, can it? I mean, I get that's a significant element, but why? You must have thought about this quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, there's a multitude of reasons. I mean, the first one is, like, people do, I mean, recruitment is a big issue, the way we do it. You know, if you ask for someone who's got Russell Group qualification, for example, you're immediately knocking a lot of people out because they can't afford to go to that kind of university. It does depend on how you recruit. People do recruit in their own image. It depends on whether you have access to careers advice in schools, which kind of presents PR and comms as a suitable option. Often, if you're from a working class background, there is research that shows that career aspirations can be limited by parents who want safety for their kids. And what they mean by that is something that's very similar to the work that they do themselves, which might be more kind of like labor based. So there's a whole host of reasons, but ultimately we're just not seeing the diversity that we should do in our profession. And this is just an intervention that will hopefully help people who are from lower economic backgrounds and underserved groups to get a foot on the ladder and increase their earning potential.
Right. So go on then. How do you hope and see that Socially Mobile will help increase the number of, lower socioeconomic people, for background people in public relations?
So what we've done is we've looked very specifically at the types of interventions available and the types of interventions we think could be most effective in helping solve this issue. And we've identified this challenge that exists once a practitioner has spent maybe 2 or 3 years in practice. So they've got the basic craft skills, they've got rudimentary experience and good tactical proficiency. But what they haven't got is the management expertise to progress into a more strategic role. So the skills of presentation, of horizon scanning, of management, of team management and such like. So it's that where we're looking explicitly to make an intervention. Throughout lockdown, Sarah's done a huge amount of learning and development herself and has attended a number of exec education programs. And it's that model that we borrowed and brought to bear for the public relations industry. So we built a 10-week exec education program with a mix of formal learning and reflective learning, a series of compulsory modules, so 7 compulsory modules, and then a series of modules suited to the individual practitioner that will help people firmly make that transition. And business models, there's some innovation there as well. We're making this platform completely open so people can buy a place employers can fund a place for practitioners that identify with this need. And it's those funded places that provide the provision for pay places for people from working class background.
Yeah, so can I just chip in there? There's actually a reason for that business model, and it's twofold. One is to help with the financial sustainability of the CIC. It gives us an income that will keep us moving forward, being able to reinvest in the platform, so nothing comes back out other than costs associated with the community interest company. The other thing, it's a really, really important reason that we have these pay places. We don't want any shame or stigma to be associated with Socially Mobile. We want it to be a really positive learning experience that changes people's lives. We want it to be transformative. And we're very aware that, you know, it can be very difficult for people to share their personal circumstances in order to be able to get a fully funded place. So the reason for having, like I say, the reason for having pay places is twofold. It takes away any shame or stigma because nobody knows who's got a fully funded place and who's got a pay place. And also, like I say, it creates a kind of financial buffer for us. It means that we know, rather than having to do huge rounds of sponsorship seeking on a regular basis, which we think is challenging, bearing in mind the current marketplace. It might be boom time post COVID, but actually a lot of companies have had a very difficult time over the last 18 months. We think this is a really realistic and strong way to go forward.
Fine. So
So if I wanted to do it, I can just go onto the social mobile website and buy a place, in essence, if you see what I mean. Anyone can do that. And go on, how much is it? If anyone if anyone's listening to this, fancies it, go and give it.
So it's priced at $695 for an individual seat. Right.
And that's for a 10-week course, in essence. And we'll come on to the modules in a minute, because that's, I think that's really interesting. But the but then just talk us through the sponsorship bit again. If an agency CEO is listening to this and think, oh, actually, I might get involved with this, how does it work? They ring you up and, in essence, pay for either one of their employees or somebody else to who they may or may not have met to go through the course. Is that you can do it either
exactly
way?
Exactly that. You've nailed it. And ultimately, what they're doing is, by potentially training a member of their own team, they're actually supporting somebody else to get on the foot on the ladder as well. So it's a really lovely model in that way, in terms of there's a quite a nice feel good factor to being involved. You can put somebody on within your team or a number of different people, and you're basically helping other people succeed too. Yeah. And we're creating a lovely alumni afterwards as well. So we've got Guild who've come on board. We're really grateful to Michelle Goodall, who's helped us with this free of charge. They're providing space on their community platform. So there's a safe space for anybody who goes through the program, so they can create their own network. They can liaise with teachers and they can, you know, hopefully share knowledge and advice with each other and potentially job specs and just talk to each other about what they're doing. And I think that's really important. And that's also a really key benefit of being on Socially Mobile.
We should recognize that we're pushing into an industry that recognizes the challenge. You know, diversity over the last 5 years has become a huge issue for the industry. So the response to the Socially Mobile proposition has been fantastic. And Ben, as you suggest, you know, we have had a number of agencies and in fact, other organisations step forward and help us actually provide the seed funding to get it off the ground. So, you know, if you don't mind, I'll thank them all. Don't Cry Wolf, Coverage Bookers, and Porta Novelli, Story Resonance, and Flashman Hillard have all helped.
Well, well done to them. When you touched on it a minute ago, Seema, I just want to talk a little bit about some of the modules, because there's some core ones and then you can specialise. Just give us a quick rundown on those.
Yeah, so we thought two things. We thought really hard about the learning design and how we structured the programme. We thought really hard about the syllabus and the skills that are needed to make that transition. And I think everybody recognises you spend 2 to 3 years in practice, you gain some rudimentary skills, you know, writing, media relations, pitching and such like, but you don't develop the skills in planning and team management and such like. And that's where you need help to make that transition to a more strategic role and to increase, you know, to increase your earning potential.
Sure. So, but sort of everyone does, don't they? I mean, just hearing you, but what you're saying is that people from, if you haven't been to university, if you haven't been to public school, you're less likely to have them than those who have, is it? And that's where Socially Mobile helps.
But I think it's generally there's an issue and a requirement within our industry to make that transition from the tactical role into the more managerial role. So yeah, so we've designed a series of seven classrooms, if you like, focusing on core skills, creativity, planning and measurement, financial management, technology, and managing a team. And you can see, you know, those are the skills that you need to go from that tactical entry level role with 2 to 3 years experience into, you know, a more senior practitioner role. And then there's also a series of, you know, specialist management capabilities. And here we've got three optional classrooms out of, you know, five, where you can focus on maybe aspects that are of particular interest to you as an individual. So around building better organizations, change management, maybe starting your own business, strategy and growth and leadership and culture.
Actually, Stephen, that's a really important point on the starting your own business, because what we do recognise is that while we say 2 years experience minimum, there may be people who have actually got quite a bit more than that, and they may be just frustrated that they might be, you know, trying to push up in their own organization, not very successfully. They might be looking for a new job, but actually there will be people who'll be thinking, do you know what? I think this is time for me to do it myself. Maybe this is the way I past all my barriers. That's the reason I started my own business. A woman had had two kids on the bounce and wasn't really, well, I had them at that point. I really wanted to have kids and I was struggling in the workplace. I got around the issues by setting up my own business and creating a business that would work for me. And there will be people like that in our cohorts, and we're very aware of that. So we wanted to make sure that while that wasn't part of the obligatory learning, that if you wanted to learn a bit more about what setting up a business looks like, that people would have that choice, that option.
Right. Now, one of the things that interested me when I heard about it originally was that you're not actually trying to increase, or one of your, you're not trying to increase the number of working class and minority groups that enter the sector. You're concentrating on helping them grow their skills and get promoted and stay in the sector, which is quite different from quite a few of the other schemes that are out there. Why did you decide to go down that quite specific route?
Am I taking that, are you?
Yeah, you go there. I mean, you know, go back to your time at the CIPR where you spotted this particular need.
I think it's just really interesting in terms of there are specific interventions out there already. For example, there's the PRCA apprenticeship scheme. You know, you've got Taylor Bennett Foundation. There are some absolutely fantastic schemes out there and we're all pulling towards the same cause. It's, you know, it's fantastic to see the diversity and number of different initiatives where we're all trying to make a difference for the right reasons and create a stronger PR industry. This is very specific though, because it will be a generational change. This is about, we're seeing people, if for example, take our Black, Asian and ethnic minority colleagues, they may be very slightly now increasing in number and kinds of curves in terms of coming into our sector, I'll put my teeth in, but actually they're still not moving up in terms of seniority. So we're trying to make sure that that happens. And I think, you know, the more we do that, the more that, you know, the more diverse we get as a sector, the more we'll start to recruit again in our own image. So it will help the diversity. Like I say, it will make a difference, but it's going to take a little while. I'd love to do something that looks at how we increase, different people, for example, you know, like school leavers coming into our industry, but there's only so much you can do with one thing. This is a passion project outside of our day jobs and outside of our family lives. So we've got to make this work, and that's really what our focus is on right now. But like I say, we know that there's a pinch point at that point where people have had a couple of years' experience. They just can't seem to break through, and that's the bit that we want to help at this specific point in time.
Yeah, I mean, I do get the impression that quite a few people from minority groups leave public relations after a few years. So in that sense, it's a scheme that could work well, I would have thought.
Or they start their own businesses and they shouldn't have to do that. Do you know what I mean?
Or some of them just leave. I mean, you know.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah.
There's also a factor around change, and change takes a long, long time. You know, we need any number of these initiatives, and it's not no single one is a zero-sum game. We're a professional body of around 100,000 people. That's PRCA data. It's also, you can go and check out Sales Navigator yourself on LinkedIn. But, you know, that number seems to be consistent. And, all these initiatives added together are making change, but it's slow. You know, the apprenticeship numbers, we're seeing 30 to 50 people come into the profession a year. We're hoping to have cohorts of similar sort of number. You need lots and lots of these interventions to bring about change, and, you know, eventually it will happen. But Sarah said it's going to be generational.
But do you think, you know, just thinking about what both of you just said, does PR have a recruitment problem amongst the lower socioeconomic background or people, or does it have a retention issue or both? And which one is more serious, I suppose?
I couldn't really speak to the retention issue, if I'm really honest. We definitely have, as we said from the stats at the very beginning, at the outset, there's definitely a recruitment issue. And if you look at recruitment practices, if we're honest with ourselves, if you were to say, what does a standard recruitment practice look like, it tends to be quite short notice because it's reactive to a particular issue because someone's put their notice in. There's probably kind of like a template of requirements. It will be a certain kind of graduate probably because you want a quick fix to a difficult solution because you've got a client and a commercial imperative that you need to deal with. And actually, we need to take a much longer look at how we recruit. And to quote some work there, Rowan Shaw wrote for Future Proof. I think it was Future Proof 4, did a really interesting piece. Another lady called Joanna Obeyi wrote something as well, also on recruitment, about the fact that we just don't approach it appropriately and in a long-term fashion, so that we should be much more thoughtful and strategic about it. So, and it should be an ongoing process. And that means thinking about what your workforce looks like, who you want to fill in, where the gaps are, how you're going to find them. And that can actually take quite a lot of time and actually go back to even redesigning what that recruitment template looks like, what your salary base looks like. Should you be even asking the question about salary? You know, the debate is that probably not. And actually, which groups are you going into? Are you actually in the right networks? Are you posting on the right jobs boards? You know, because if you're just posting in your usual networks and your network's full of white people, you're just going to get more of the same. And unfortunately, we seem to be trapped in this kind of habit. And if we're honest with ourselves, that is generally what happens. And if, you know, I've worked for quite a few different agencies in the past, I still see it happening today. And you really do have to put work and effort in, really do, to make a difference. And also, it can be quite scary to look at how you would normally recruit and tear that up, because there's a risk associated with perhaps taking a school leave, but there's additional time and effort and energy and cost that goes into that. But ultimately, that's where the change will come. But not everybody is prepared to commit to that at this point in time. So this is why all the different initiatives are so important.
I think the challenges we have, to Sarah's point, we hire in our own image and continue to do so. And we see at the moment, you know, the industry is booming. All the data points to strong growth, and we're screaming within agency land to hire both at that account manager and account director level, the specific level we're trying to address through Socially Mobile, and also at entry level with account executives. You know, there's this huge dearth of talent, and it's to Sarah's point, because we're looking in the same places that we always have. And it's really interesting, if you look at the agencies that don't have talent problems, the ones with the really strong employer propositions that are growing and thriving through this time, it's agencies like Don't Cry Wolf and it's Manifest that you know are breaking the mold and are hiring from outside the PR industry.
It's always tough though in that recruitment thing, isn't it? Because you've got that long term what everyone would like to do versus the short term, oh my goodness, we've got a client and we haven't got enough people and we need to do something quick. And
That's why I bet it needs management buy-in. You can't just do it overnight, and they need to just get on with it. And it needs to be an ongoing process. It's not just something that you stop and start because someone's put their notice in, or because all of a sudden you're taking on a client and you've got, you know, you've basically got a talent need. That's a pretty bad practice, actually. It's standard practice, but it's not good practice. Good practice is making sure that you do have a strong brand proposition, that you have strong mission, vision, and values. You know, we talk about it, we don't necessarily do it very well. You know, and also, you know, you continue that recruitment process, and you have ways in which you can attract people at different stages in their career from different backgrounds and perhaps from different industries. I mean, we do take on people who come from different industries all the time, so we can transition people. We can transition people who've worked in media, want to get into public relations. We're just real laggards in doing this, but this could be and is transformational for the organizations that do it. You know, public sector do it better because they have to, you know, they're audited on this stuff. You know, if we've made this, as this became, you know, something that you absolutely had to do because there was regulation in place, which I would welcome personally, it would be hugely different. Same with, you know, things like gender pay gap. The minute regulation goes into place, and it has to be not just for over 250 employees, it needs to be under that, it makes a big difference, because you're forced to look at it, you're forced to act. And yes, it's hard, but ultimately it's better for everybody in the long run.
Right, just going back to Socially Mobile, how does it, well, I think you talked a bit about how it compares to some of these other schemes that are around, but presumably that one of the challenges is to integrate with them as well, because there's some fantastic organizations that have been launched in a few years, aren't there, they all have the aim to increase the diversity within the sector. I'm talking about the likes of Blueprint. You mentioned the PRCA's apprenticeship scheme, Black Comms Network, Taylor Bennett Foundation, people like us more recently. And there's some brilliance. There's a lot of great stuff going on. And presumably, well, it's important all of you and all of those other guys all kind of somehow need to work together and or not. I don't know. How do you see all that working?
we all, you know, do you know what's great about it is that everybody's supportive of each other. You know, they are all, as you said, every single one of them is doing fantastic work within our industry and are all massively worthy of support. We all have slightly different objectives, which is great. I mean, obviously ours is very intersectional. It's very focused on socioeconomic diversity, which obviously gives us a slightly different slant. We're also looking at supporting people with disabilities who are really badly served within our industry. If you look around, if you can tell me what initiatives there are and support there is for those people, please let me know, because I've been asking and I've been looking and I can't find it. You know, women returners, we're also looking at them. But so, you know, all of these organizations are very important because they've all spotted a slightly different issue and they're all working really hard to fix those and find a solution. And it's good that they're all gathering pace. And like I say, we all kind of work hand in hand. We all share each. I've noticed that we've all started sharing each other's content. And I think that's really important to drive awareness and also footfall and signups where needed. And I really welcome that. I think it's great. And, you know, we've had the question before, you know, okay, two white people setting up socially mobile, you know, this is about diversity. Is that, you know, is that a right thing to do? And my argument for me is I'm not going to shy away from that question. Absolutely it is. You know, this, you know, diversity is not the issue of anybody but white people, because actually that we are the people who are dominating our industry right now, and we do need to diversify, and it's up to us to find the solutions with our colleagues who can help, with our disabled colleagues, with the women returners, with our Black, Asian, ethnic and minority friends. You know, that's how you do it. So you do it together. But, you know, we've got the context, we've got the influence at the moment. We've been able to find the seed funding, Stephen and I, with now support with our founding sponsors. And it's really right that we lead this drive. And fingers crossed, it will really make a big difference too. Even if it's just a small number of people at the outset, we can hopefully scale. And in time, all the people who go through will hopefully be the leaders of the future who change things for the next generation. And that's quite uplifting when you think about it. And when you consider this has taken a long time to come to fruition.
it is also a generational. Every single one of these organizations is the start of a really important conversation and community, and you need that kind of level of activity, I would suggest, to make the changes that we need to see in the industry.
And what is, we were chatting about this on the pre-show chat the other day, what is success on this stuff? I mean, success in a sense is if you make a big difference to one person's life, right? That's success, isn't it? But on the other side of that, you know, there's quite a, so some of these schemes is quite low numbers, aren't they, at the moment? We all want them to do probably scale a bit more than they are, but maybe that's unrealistic. I don't know. What do you guys think of that?
So we thought hard about scaling, and you know, at the moment we want to get this first cohort underway and prove the concept. And you know, we think we've been ambitious in you know, pushing 30 or 40 people through this first cohort in the spring. But you're right, you know, we're pushing against an industry of 100,000 people, to Sarah's point, 3,500 people at least impacted by this issue that we need to level up. So you can see from a pure numbers game, you know, we need to do something around scale. You know, every single person though that we push through the scheme and make a difference to, and I'm absolutely convinced the individual we propose will make a significant difference. You know, if they then go on to improve their outlook and, you know, their position in the industry, then that's a positive thing, and through that we'll create scaling. But it's something, yes, we're thinking really hard about.
Go on, Sarah. Your final word from you. Just give it a quick remind people how they can get involved again, because the closing date's coming up, right?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Ultimately, if you want to apply for this first cohort, there are still a few places available. The application form can be found at sociallymobile.org.uk. The deadline is the 3rd of December. There will be, in that following week, decisions made about who is accepted, and that notification will go out. There's an onboarding session the following week. I think it's the 17th. And then the course starts in earnest at the start. I think it's the 10th of January and runs through to 25th of March. It's a massively fantastic program. I can say that hand on heart because we've worked through all the different content provided by our teachers. The teachers are some of the best people you will find in our industry. Stephen and I were blown away by the videos when we watched them. So as he said before, every single week, there's a particular topic you watch. One or two videos, there may be, or a live session. We're really fortunate that Kate Hartley from Pompeo is doing a live crisis simulation at one point. There's a little bit of reflective homework and some reading to do. Ultimately, you know, like we watched it, it's a bit like future-proof. It proves itself, and the success of it is down to the generosity and the knowledge of those involved. And we got some absolutely brilliant people, and we can't say thank you enough. So if you are from one of our groups and you want a fully funded place, if you're from a lower socioeconomic background, if you're a Black, Asian, ethnic minority colleague or have a disability, or you're a woman returner and you think that we can help, please do apply. You know, if also you're finding yourself in some kind of financial situation, we will look at those as well. If you put an application in, because we ask you to build a case for why you think you're suitable for funding, you know, we will look at that. And please do get involved. And all I can say is thanks, everybody, including you, Ben, for the support and for featuring us today, and to the people who've got involved so generously, both for teaching, by sponsoring, but also volunteering, because we have people who are helping in terms of sifting through our applications and who are actually going to do the marking for us. And they're all specialists and you know, professionals who've got lots and lots of years of experience who don't need to do this. They're doing it because they see the value of this particular initiative. So we're just grateful.
It's all virtual. We haven't really talked about that, but I just assumed it is, right? So that in that sense, if people are thinking of applying, it's logistically, they haven't got to get on a train and go anywhere. It's all virtual.
No, it's as easy as pie in terms of we are